Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's lovely to be here, and welcome to you all. Those behind you, I'm afraid you'll just be seeing my back for this lecture. I'm sorry about that. It's my best part, though. And also, welcome to those of you who are listening on tape or on one of these discs. This is a very interesting lecture. I'm going to talk to you about Richard Dawkins' recent book, The God Delusion, and I'm going to be critical of it. I'm not going to be critical of Richard Dawkins. I'm going to be engaging with the ideas. I don't know Richard Dawkins very well. I have written to him saying that the two of us ought to have a face-to-face debate because clearly these are very interesting topics. He's not here tonight, so I'm afraid it's just me. What I'm going to do is to try and open up some of the questions that he's asked and really look at them and ask whether the objections he raises are quite as significant as he thinks. Now, many of you will know Richard Dawkins. You've probably seen him cycling around Oxford. He's written many books, and I just put some of them on the screen behind me. The one I first came across when I was studying molecular biophysics under George Rada in the Department of Biochemistry was The Selfish Gene. And of course, since then, Dawkins has produced many books looking at various aspects of evolutionary biology. But we've seen a transition, I think, a transition from a very gifted popularizer of sciences to someone who seems to have increasingly been animated by an anti-religious agenda. And we see it, I think, most clearly in this most recent book, The God Delusion, published only last year. It's a very significant book. It certainly attracted a lot of attention. And what I want to do is to try and look at some of the arguments he develops in this book and ask how well they stand up. I don't propose to prove God's existence or anything like that. What I do want to do is to try and look at the specific arguments that he raises and ask how reliable they are. Now, it's a book which is out to convert us. He writes, "If this book works as I intend, religious readers who open it will be atheists when they put it down." So clearly, he is someone who has moved away from what I think may have been a very nominal Anglican faith to a very aggressive, and I think, if I dare say it, rather dogmatic form of atheism. In my own case, I actually went the other direction. I grew up in Northern Ireland. You probably can't tell that from the accent. It's kind of where I got lost. But certainly when I was growing up in Northern Ireland, things there were getting quite exciting. What we euphemistically call the Troubles were beginning to break out, and it seemed to me as obvious could be, that religion simply led to violence. And if you wanted to get rid of violence in the world, you got rid of religion. And I was certainly an atheist in my early days at school, indeed till I came up to Oxford in 1971. And atheists, as I think you all know, come in different shades. Some, you know, say, well, of course, I don't personally believe in God, but I'm so glad you do. I wasn't that kind of atheist. I was the kind of atheist who said anybody who believes in God is mad, bad, or sad, and wanted to really try and eliminate religious faith as quickly as I could. And, of course, I was studying sciences, and for me, sciences were wonderful because science just pulled the rug out from under belief in God altogether. If you were a scientist, you could let God have it with both barrels, so to speak. It just kind of way swept the ground under belief in God. Then I came to Oxford to read chemistry, and I really found I was forced to rethink things in a very big way. I think, if I could just mention one or two of those things, I think I began to realize that the evidential basis, the robustness of the arguments that I knew for atheism actually weren't anything like as good as I'd thought. And I also began to discover that actually Christians were really challenging me at points where I found I couldn't quite give as good answers as I would like. And to cut a very long story short, I became a Christian and moved slowly but surely from science to theology. And indeed, my specialist interest today is the relationship of science and Christian faith. Interestingly, Dawkins and I, therefore, have traveled similar paths, but in quite opposite directions. How would Dawkins account for me in terms of the ideas we find in the God Delusion? Well, I fear I'm offered relatively few ways of making sense of myself. Either because I believe in God, I am mad or bad or deluded, having been kind of hijacked mentally by some kind of God virus, or else, because I've been hijacked by some kind of God virus, I am mad, bad, and deluded, and believe in God. And I mean, it's not the most compelling of arguments. And really, I think it brings us to one of the most interesting questions which we need to look at tonight. Why does Richard Dawkins need to write this book at all? because atheists have been saying for years that belief in God is dying out. That it's just a matter of time before it finally disappears, and that's it. And the problem is, that hasn't happened. Indeed, in most places, not necessarily Western Europe, but certainly the United States and elsewhere, belief in God is resurgent. Michael Shermer, who's president of the Skeptic Society, wrote very, very recently that never at any point in history before have so many people and such a great proportion of people actually believed in God. So actually, we are seeing a crisis of confidence within atheism. Why is belief in God still around when it should have died out all those years ago? So I think in many ways we can understand why this book has been written. It's written to try and put the final nail in God's coffin. And therefore it's good to try and look at the sort of arguments that Dawkins develops. And basically there are four major arguments, although of course there are many sub-arguments interwoven into the narrative. And I'm afraid I've only got time tonight really to look at these four, and I fear not in great detail. So you must forgive me if I don't go into enough detail, but I assure you we'll have a time of questions afterwards, and I'd be very, very happy to follow anything through to the depth that you would like. Here are the points. First of all, that belief in God is irrational. That's a very significant part of Dawkins' way of looking at things. Secondly, and of course this relates very, very naturally to Dawkins' own interest in science and indeed his position here at Oxford as professor of the public understanding of science. Science shows us there is no God. Science, if you like, removes the conceptual space that God used to inhabit. Moving on from there, faith in God, where it does exist, can be explained away on scientific grounds. It's not that there is a God, it is that there are other factors which make us think that there might be one, or make us want to believe that there's a God. And then finally, and I think actually most importantly from the point of view of this volume, faith in God leads to violence. Now, all of these points are significant, and they all need answers. And therefore, in this lecture tonight, I'm going to try and explore these a little bit and offer a kind of response. Again, I apologize that we haven't got enough time to do this in detail, but I hope I'll at least be able to give you an idea of what might be said. We begin by looking at the idea that belief in God is irrational. And Dawkins is very, very clear, I think, that faith is a very significant thing. It makes people do things. It gives people a kind of way of looking at life. It's really important. And therefore, you must be critical about it. And Dawkins' argument is that people who believe in God have simply absorbed this uncritically without thinking about it. Now, I agree with them up to a point. I think we must all be critical about the faiths that we hold. But I just extend this to include another faith that Dawkins doesn't. Let me tell you about this. Now, I published a book about 2.5 years ago called Dawkins' God, which basically looks at Dawkins' scientific arguments for the non-existence of God. And since publishing that book, I've kind of been going around the country giving lectures, basically setting out Dawkins' arguments and then offering a response. And after one of these lectures, I was accosted by somebody who was extremely angry with me. He wagged his finger in a very exciting and enticing way. I gathered my friends around me, asked him what the matter was. He said, "You have ruined my life." I was very sad. He said, "You know, I have based my life on what Richard Dawkins has said, and you have destroyed my faith. I can no longer believe his arguments." Now, part of me thought, well, maybe you just need a bit more critical about what you believe. But on the other hand, you can see that this is right, isn't it? What Dawkins is saying is right here, that what we believe really does have a very big impact on the way in which we structure our lives. There's a need to think about these things. But my point is simply this. Atheism, too, is a belief system. It's a worldview. And we must be critical about that. One of the most fundamental criticisms directed against Dawkins' God delusion is he directs a withering criticism against religion, but seems to think he's exempt from any such criticism himself. Let's begin then. Belief in God is irrational. One of Dawkins' most, I think, well-known arguments is that faith in God is infantile. It's fine for children, but we grow out of these things. And those who remain believers in God in adulthood are just people who are so seriously deluded that really one can only feel sorry for them. Now, that's an interesting argument. Dawkins is proposing an analogy. On the one hand, we have belief in God. On the other hand, we have other beliefs. And for the benefit of those of you who listen to the tape, or indeed are behind me, I've put on the screen very elegant portrayals of the Tooth Fairy and Santa Claus. Dawkins' argument goes like this. Belief in God is analogous to believing in a Tooth Fairy or Santa Claus. These are childish beliefs. And when you grow up, you leave them behind. I mean, and if you're into this kind of thing, I mean, it's a neat little argument. But there is always a question about an argument based on analogy, and it's whether the analogy is valid. Now, I think I gave up believing in Santa Claus about the age of 5. However, not unaware that there were certain advantages to maintaining this belief, I have to tell you, I let my parents think I still believed until I was about 9 or 10. But here's the point I want to make. I would be very interested to meet someone here who started believing in Santa Claus when they're about 50 or 60. I think we'd all be very interested in meeting someone like that. But you can see immediately the analogy doesn't work. Lots of people, I'm one of them, discover God later in life when things suddenly click together and you realize that's it, it makes sense of things. You may know the very famous story of Anthony Flew, the leading British atheist philosopher, who I remember studying in some detail when I was doing theology back in the 70s. You know, he was a very, very able atheist author, very, very able critic of religion. In the last 2 or 3 years, he's decided there is a God after all, and is writing his spiritual autobiography to tell us why he changed his mind. I think we need to be careful about this. There's no evidence to suggest a belief in God is either infantile or infantilizing. It actually is a kind of belief that people come to, and it makes such a difference they hold on to it. Now, Dawkins argues that belief in God is, and you can see this quote here, a persistently false belief held in the face of strong contradictory evidence. And of course, many of you will know that definition very well, but there are some very interesting points here. What is the strong contradictory evidence he has in mind? If you're an atheist, you've got to look at one piece of strong contradictory evidence which actually is important here. Why is it that so many people believe in God? Dawkins has an answer to this. We'll look at that shortly. But the key point is that every worldview has its weak point. A worldview, you know, a whole way of looking at life. Whatever you believe, there's a point where theory and reality don't quite match. If you're a Christian, I suspect it's probably the whole issue of suffering in the world. But if you're an atheist, it's why there are so many people who believe in God, because really your only options are to say they're deluded, they are mad, or they are bad. And that's what we find, actually, in Richard Dawkins' arguments. So let's try and look at this in somewhat more detail. We'll look at the whole question of faith and proof, and it's perfectly reasonable to ask, can God's existence be proved? Now, certainly, one can give very good reasons for that. One can give a whole accumulation of reasons, say there is this and there is this and there is this, but there's no knockdown proof. Nothing that says with 100% certainty, that's it, end of argument. But actually, the same is also true on the atheist side of the argument. It's an extremely important point. Dawkins does talk, I think in rather grandiose terms, about not being able to disprove a negative, which I think he finds a compelling argument. The point I'd want to make is the world is so complex that any explanation you offer is going to go way beyond the available evidence. So in fact, whether you're a Christian or an atheist, you're actually taking the position that we can make sense of this and come to an outcome. And that's a very significant conclusion indeed. And the real point I want to make here is that actually we need to begin to think about atheism itself being a faith, in that it cannot prove its case with total certainty. And in many ways, we need to go to the sciences here and ask a very simple question. We'll look at the relationship between science and faith in a moment, but if the natural sciences necessitate neither atheism nor religious faith, as I will argue in a moment, is the case. Where do we go? Well, I think basically we simply have two options. We say, look, the question lies beyond resolution altogether. Let's just leave this and go and talk about something else. Well, if we say, actually, this can be resolved, but it is resolved on other grounds. Now, again, it's an extremely important point. And many of you who've studied philosophy will know that the big question here really is inference to the best explanation. In other words, it's not a question of knockdown proof, two and two make four. I mean, what's the meaning of life? That's a bigger question. It has to be answered in different ways. Why are we here? What's the world all about? Gilbert Harman, many years ago, made the point that when you come to really complex systems, there is no way in which you can say, this proves this. The real issue is, what's the best explanation? What's the best way of making sense of what we observe? And as you all know, that simply does not lead to knockdown answers. It leaves the questions tantalizingly open, and really it moves us into a different ballpark than that in which Richard Dawkins is playing. Dawkins, I think, seems to assume that you can move effortlessly from saying the chemical formula for water is H2O to the meaning of life is fill in the gap. It's a very important point, I think. And again, if I have time, I talk about this in more detail. But again, you might think of this. How do you go about judging a worldview? Well, one answer you might give is this. What way of looking at things, what way of thinking actually makes the best sense of what we see around us in the world? It's not about proof, but it's really what is the resonance, what's the overlap, what's the fit between the way we think and what we actually see in the world. And of course, Dawkins has his own very distinct answer to this. In his book, River Out of Eden, he says, look, the world that we observe has precisely the properties you should expect if there is, look at his very famous quote, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. What he's saying is, here's my worldview, there's the world, they fit, they overlap. Maybe they do. But of course, others do as well. And here's the very famous quote from C.S. Lewis that many of you will know. He writes, I believe in Christianity as I believe the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it I see everything else. In other words, it offers you a way of looking at the world, a way of viewing it, a kind of prism through which you look, and it gives you a way of making sense of things which actually seems more satisfying than anything else. That's a very important point. And it does move us, I'm afraid, way beyond simple proof-disproof statements to much more complex ways of engaging the world. Now again, that needs far more detailed discussion than I can give it. But I want to move on, if I may, and look at Dawkins' second major point. Science shows us that there is no God. And Dawkins is very clear. Real scientists, as opposed to pseudoscientists, do not believe in God. He talks about the Neville Chamberlain School of Scientists who do believe in God and therefore are some kind of appeasers of religion. It's a rather puzzling way of thinking. It's also, I think, a rather questionable way of thinking. Because there is this very obvious question one might want to ask. Why are so many scientists Christians? In a typical college CU, most of the members will be scientists. Why is that? What's the explanation for that? Just to fill this in a little bit. In 2006, Richard Dawkins published The God Delusion. But two other books were published in that same year. Francis Collins, who directs the Human Genome Project in the United States, published his book, The Language of God. Owen Gingerich, who's professor of astronomy at Harvard, published God's Universe. These are both serious, significant scientists, peer-reviewed publications, well-regarded inside a constituency. Both these books are saying that belief in God, in fact, more than that, belief in the Christian way of thinking about God, offers you the best way of making sense of the way the world is. This isn't what Dawkins, I think, wants you to hear. But it needs to be heard, because immediately I think it raises very serious question marks about what I think is a rather simplistic mantra. Science disproves God, or science makes it impossible to believe in God. It's just not like that. And again, there are many things one could say in response to this. Let me just try and go through some of them. One of the most important points here is simply to recognize that actually there are limits to what the sciences can tell us. Now, Dawkins, I think, is resistant to this. He argues that science proves things with certainty, and therefore that there is a kind of intellectual motorway, superhighway, between the sciences and atheism. But again, there are so many scientists who are religious believers that the initial plausibility of that really is very open to question. I mean, he argues that anything worth knowing can be proved by science, and everything else, such as belief in God, is just delusion or wishful thinking. And again, you'll find similar viewpoints, for example, in Bertrand Russell. Many years ago, he writes, "Whatever knowledge is attainable must be attained by scientific methods, and what science cannot discover, mankind cannot know." Well, that's one viewpoint. Here's another one. There's an Oxford scientist, Sir Peter Medawar. There's a Medawar building in Oxford, which is basically there to his memory. He won the Nobel Prize for Medicine in 1960 for his work on immunobiology. In 1987, Peter Medawar, who was a self-confessed rationalist, published a book called The Limits of Science. Interesting title. And he argued that when it came to making sense of the material world, then in principle, there were no limits to what science could do. When it came to talking about things to do with meaning, value, God, then science really was out of its depth. And he gives this example. The existence of a limit to science is made clear by its inability to answer childlike, elementary questions like, why are we here? What's the point of living? Now, Medawar isn't rubbishing the sciences. He's simply saying they are wonderful within their proper area of operation. Or again, if you want to take an atheist scientist, take Stephen Jay Gould, who died about 4 or 5 years ago from lung cancer. Stephen Jay Gould, an atheist evolutionary biologist, who was very, very clear that the fact that he was an atheist had nothing to do with his science. He argued that the scientific method, when properly and legitimately applied, had nothing to say on the God question at all. And then he went on to make the point that if you looked at his colleagues, half of them were religious believers, half of them were not, and therefore, you know, this seemed to him to make it obvious that any suggestion that science either necessitated atheism or necessitated religious belief really was immensely simplistic. So I do want to raise some questions about this. I think many of you will probably find this a rather weak argument anyway, but it's one I think that really does need to be critiqued. There's a very interesting question here. Those of you who are philosophers will already have thought of it as I've been speaking. If the sciences are inferential in their methods, how on earth can Dawkins present atheism as the certain outcome of the scientific method? Now, you all know this point. The scientists proceed tentatively. You know, this seems to be the best way of interpreting this, but in 10 years' time, something else may come along and replace it. We can talk about what the best way of thinking at the moment is, but you're very much aware that in 10, 20, 30 years, these ways of thinking will be displaced by something else. Think, for example, of Michael Polanyi's famous book, Personal Knowledge. Polanyi, a chemist turned philosopher. He simply made the point, scientists believe that the theories they have are at present the best way of making sense of things, but they know that some of them will be shown to be wrong. The problem is they're not sure which ones. So you can see there's a real need here for provisionality, for immense caution. Again, to take one very obvious example, the Darwinian theory of evolution. Dawkins himself in Devil's Chaplain makes the point that in 100, 150 years' time, this may be displaced by something quite different. We just don't know. How on earth, with the sciences being so provisional, can he therefore say that atheism is the necessary outcome of a scientific endeavor? And again, compare with Richard Feynman, a well-known physicist, who famously said that scientific knowledge is a body of statements of varying degrees of certainty, some most unsure, some nearly sure, but none absolutely certain. It seems to me the situation is much more complicated than Dawkins allowed. I would not dream of saying that the natural sciences lead you inextricably to religious belief. I believe they could, but they don't have to. But I think on the other side, we need also make it very, very clear that they could lead you to atheism. But again, there is no reason why they should. The natural sciences are patient of atheist and Christian interpretations, but they demand neither. You've got a choice there, and you need to make that choice. Then we come to a major section in the God Delusion, which is all about explaining the origins of religion. And basically what Dawkins is going to argue is that we may offer a scientific account of why it is that people believe in God, which shows that belief in some kind of supernatural being arises from purely natural processes and does not need to be explained on the basis of believing there actually is a God. Now again, Dawkins asks some very interesting questions. Are we predisposed to believe in God? That's a really interesting question. The book of Ecclesiasticus tells us that God has planted eternity in our hearts. Augustine of Hippo in the 4th century, kind of way running with that a little bit, said something in the form of a prayer which many of you will know. You have made us for yourself, and our heart is restless till it finds its rest in you. And what both those passages are saying, really, is almost as if humanity has been made in order to relate to God. So one possibility here might be that Dawkins is simply offering a scientific account of something Christians believe to be true, but on very different grounds. But let's just follow it through. Dawkins argues there is some psychological need to believe in God. And the basic argument he lays out is really very simple, and again, many of you will know this in one form or another. There is no God, but lots of people believe in God, and therefore, of course, there has to be some explanation, and the real explanation is that they invent God to meet their needs. God is some kind of consolation or metaphysical comfort which we need if we're going to be able to survive. And again, many of you will recognize this. It's actually quite an old argument. It goes back to the 1830s when Feuerbach began to develop it. It was developed in one way by Karl Marx, who argued that the reason why we believe in God is because of social and economic alienation. Developed in another way by Sigmund Freud, who argued it's some kind of inner psychological mechanism not entirely accessible to us. And then more recently, of course, it's been developed by Richard Dawkins. So in many ways, there's a classic line of argument. But we need, I think, just to look at it more critically. So we'll go back to its origins in Feuerbach and just look at this for a few moments. In 1841, he argued this: belief in God can't arise because of the God, because there isn't a God. Therefore, it must arise from within us. It's a projection of human longings. We invent God. There isn't a God. We invent one. And of course, you all know that Freud developed that idea into the idea of the wish fulfillment later on. But let's be critical about this. It's certainly true that nothing exists because I wanted to. I mean, I might want, you might want, there to be a pile of 100-pound notes here. And I think we can all wish all night, but I'm afraid it's just not going to happen. No, it hasn't. But here's my question. Because I want something to be the case, does it follow that it cannot be the case? For example, those of you listening to me will probably have noticed that my voice is getting extremely croaky, and therefore it might be good if I could do something about that through a glass of water. I want a glass of water. I need a glass of water. Therefore, it doesn't exist. I mean, you can see there is a real weakness in the argument there, which I think needs to be exposed. But there's also another point, a deeper point. Sorry, I really did need that. It's a deeper point here. If Feuerbach's argument works at all, and it is very dubious whether it does, but if it works at all, it actually works against all worldviews. What Feuerbach is saying, look, What we do is we invent worldviews to suit our dispositions. We'd like it to be this way, so we make it be this way. And of course, that works against atheism as well. Because as many of you will know, if you looked at the cultural history of atheism since about 1780, one of the dominant themes there is atheism really gained its credibility because people wanted to be autonomous and free. If there is no God, we may do what we please. Therefore, there is no God and we are free. Think, for example, of Dostoevsky's famous novel, The Possessed, where the character Krylov says, if there is a God, I must do his will. If there is no God, I must do my will. And again, it just seems an admirable statement of that. And the real difficulty is this theory simply proves too much. Now, Dawkins basically is developing this approach. There is no God, lots of people believe in God. This is a delusion, and the key point is we need to account for how so many people are deluded in this way. Why do so many people believe in God when this is so clearly an irrational belief? Now, at this point, many people say, well, do you want to just stop there? I mean, is it actually irrational? One of the things Dawkins regularly says is, look, religious people are not allowed to think about their faith. They're not allowed to prove their faith, not allowed to actually reflect on evidence. But again, you think of C.S. Lewis. If you're a philosopher, think of Richard Swinburne. Think of Alvin Plantinga. Think of Nicholas Wolzow. Think of just about anyone. And you'll see there's a massive enterprise of exploring the rationality of faith. And C.S. Lewis illustrated very well. It's not particularly credible critique. And therefore, Dawkins moves on and offers us another. And the answer he gives is that belief in God is a virus of the mind. There's a biological explanation, or at least a biological analogy for understanding what causes religious belief. It is not that you sit down and think about this and say, well, on the basis of all this reasonable reflection, I conclude there is a God. It is that in some way your mind has been infected and therefore disrupted by a highly contagious virus. It's a very powerful image. I'm speaking just a few days after the outbreak of bird flu in Suffolk. So again, the image of a virus is very significant, something that is transmitted easily and is destructive. Again, how many viruses do you know that are nice? It's a very powerful image. But is it right? It's a very interesting question. There are some very obvious problems with this model. Let me just give you two. Number one, real viruses can be seen. In other words, you say, look, the only way we can explain the epidemiology, the only way we can explain the way this is transferred from this population is to posit some sort of entity that is transmitted in this way. We can't see it. We call it a virus. But, of course, as technology advances, it can be seen. And there is one of the biggest tobacco mosaic virus. I cannot, I fear, put on the screen a virus of the mind. For the very simple reason, no one's ever seen one. In fact, I fear I must go further and say, I don't think anyone ever is going to see one because it's so obviously a non-existent entity. But again, just pausing and thinking about this, there's a second obvious problem. On the basis of Dawkins' criteria, actually isn't atheism also a virus of the mind? There's a very serious question here. Who decides which ideas are purely reasonable and therefore are just rational, and which ones are so barking mad that they have to be explained by viruses of the mind? That's all about power. That's all about who calls the shots. And of course, Dawkins is simply saying his own ideas are perfectly reasonable and rational, and his religious opponents are viral. But the real issue, I think, is simply that there is no objective criterion here. That in many ways what Dawkins is doing is simply ending up with a very subjective, unscientific argument that his own beliefs are not viruses, but those he dislikes are. Now again, this I think is not at all persuasive, and it doesn't really carry very much weight, but he tries another approach, and you find this still vibrant in the God delusion. The God delusion talks confidently about memes, as if these were established scientific orthodoxy, which Richard Dawkins is communicating to a science-loving public, you know, with the authority of someone who is saying, this is the way it is. The meme, an idea I'm going to explain in a moment, is actually Dawkins' own invention, dating from 1976, and I have to tell you it is not taken with an enormous amount of seriousness by the scientific establishment. Basically, he invented the idea to try and argue that just as your genetic code is transmitted by genes, so ideas are transmitted by memes. And these memes, to quote from The Selfish Gene, leap from brain to brain. That's a very powerful image. Now, the problem is, no one's actually seen these things leaping from brain to brain, or in fact, even just hanging out. So, you know, there's a real question here about what this is all about. And it's been extremely influential. The word meme has been used, although happily it is now fading out of use. But there are some very obvious problems. Number one, where is the science? You know, if you are a biologist, you'll know the evidence for genes is extremely good. You can study with great precision the transmission of genetic information. There is just no equivalence here. There's no research program, there's no objective definition, there's nothing here to make this a serious scientific concept. And more significantly, again, which ideas are to be explained by memes and which ideas are just obviously right and therefore don't need explanation in this way? It's a deeply subjective judgment. And it's hardly surprising, I think, that most scientists take a rather dim view of this. This is Simon Conway Morris, who's professor of evolutionary biology, I fear at Cambridge, but we'll let that pass. Actually, some people at Cambridge may be listening to this. You didn't hear that. He writes, memes are trivial to be banished by simple mental exercises. They are hopelessly, if not hilariously, simplistic. And again, that's where most scientists are. So I just want to raise some very serious doubts about this. Now I want to come to the final section where I think a real issue is being raised. And that is that belief in God causes violence. And again, that's a very significant argument in the God delusion. And therefore, I'd like just to linger over this a little bit because I think it is a good question which needs to be looked at very carefully. Because Dawkins is surely right, I'm sure he's right, when he says that belief in God or religion, he doesn't actually make a very good distinction between belief in God and religion, I think it's an important point, has caused lots of problems like intolerance and violence. And certainly, as someone who grew up in Northern Ireland, I would say, that's right. That's right. It's not that simple. But certainly, there is a point being made there that needs to be taken seriously. We live in a world that is violent, and I'm sure all of us here tonight want to find ways of minimizing violence and finding ways which we can all live together, differing from each other, but not actually going to war over it. So there is, I think, a real point being made here. The question I want to ask is this. Is this characteristic of religion? It's a very important point. The point I'm going to try and make is this. Religion is a very, very broad concept. And Dawkins very often takes as representative fanatical elements. Those of you who saw his rather curious TV series, The Root of All Evil, will know all about this. He zoomed in on, I think it was three people, who I personally would say were slightly on the weird end of things, and presented them as if these were mainstream. And again, you know, people were very, very cross about this. This was misrepresentation. They were very, very angry. But the difficulty is, if he'd focused on normal people, there wouldn't have been a program. And that's the issue, really. So let's agree religion can lead to violence. What about, for example, 9/11? It's a very important point. But if you look at Robert Pape's very interesting study of suicide bombings, where he looks at every suicide bombing since they began to the present day, basically what he finds is that religion is very often part of the picture, but it's never the decisive factor. Religion is neither the necessary nor the sufficient condition. If there is a sufficient condition for a suicide bomber, it is a belief that you are in such a hopeless situation that there is nothing you can do to change things other than use yourself as a weapon. And it's typically found in situations where people are being occupied by a foreign power and feel the need to protest in some way. There can be a religious element, but it's there amongst others. Let me move on, if I may. I think Dawkins would have made that point with great force if this were the year 1907. But of course, the 20th century saw atheism actually come to power. And the real problem is that atheism in the 20th century actually has shown itself to be, well, let me just put it like this, not really very good on human rights issues. For example, if you think of the Soviet Union between about 1918 and 1941, you know, the enormous amount of destruction of church property, but also, of course, of priests in order to advance a Soviet atheistic agenda. That's part of the picture. And the paradox of all of this is simply that those who executed, oppressed people for their religious faith felt that they were working for a better world by removing the causes of intolerance. And the real problem is that we are fanatics on the religious side, but also, I fear, on the irreligious side as well. Isn't the real issue here how we deal with fanatics, whatever they are? We're here in Oxford, and you know there are people who are really concerned about animal rights. Some of them take it very, very far. I have sympathy with them, but you can see it leads to a fanatical approach. The question is, how can we have legitimate beliefs without them being allowed to move into this realm where they begin to become dangerous to others? And that's not about the abolition of religion. It's about its reformation. And that seems to me to be a very important point. But the real truth, I think, actually doesn't have very much to do with religion or indeed anti-religion. I think it's to do with human nature. There seems to be something about the way we are made, which means that some things, you know, raise us up to want to do very, very good things, and some things drag us down to do very bad things as well. And I think the real difficulty is that in each of us, there might well be a fanatic. We just haven't yet found out what we want to be fanatical about. So there's a real challenge to us here about how we control ourselves as individuals, but also how we control each other as groups. Let's move on. Dawkins, I think, makes a further point, which is a good point, I think. He argues that religion provides a transcendent motivation for violence. In other words, if there is a God, then that is a higher authority, so to speak. And that, I think, can be a very significant argument for violence. Of course, there is that interesting point, and I'll come back to this. What happens if that transcendent authority urges us to be peacemakers? Blessed are the peacemakers, for theirs is the kingdom of God. So there is an interesting side to the argument I want to come back to, but it's not actually that simple. I must apologize for this dreadful word, but we're talking about the transcendentalization of human values. I'm sorry about that word. It reminds me of an American friend of mine who was a doctor, and I asked him how things were going. He said, oh dear, well, we had a negative patient care outcome scenario yesterday. The patient died. You see, so it sounds an awful word, but I think when you see what I'm trying to get at, I think it's the only word I can use. This is what happens when you believe there is no God and you fill the vacuum with something else. You make something that is purely human as if it were divine, as if it were completely beyond challenge of any kind and elevated right to the top. And of course, you can think of many examples of this. I'll just give you one. And this, of course, is Madame Roland. Many of you will know her sad little story. She was executed on trumped-up charges during the nastier period of the French Revolution, and she was executed in 1793. And as she was being taken to the guillotine, she pointed to a Statue of Liberty in the Place de la Révolution, and she spoke these words, "Liberty, what crimes are committed in your name?" And those are powerful words. I think they say something to us that very often we make something God, and it becomes the justification for whatever we want to do. It is the end that justifies whatever means we choose to use. And again, that's a danger for all of us, I think. The need to be aware that we can do this, the need to challenge that. But there is an interesting question here if you're a Christian. Dawkins is extremely rude about God. But interestingly, when he starts to talk about Jesus, he begins to realize that the kind of attitude that we find in Jesus does not sit at all well with his religion leads to violence mantra. Jesus had violence done to him, but he did no violence and condoned violence for no one. Dawkins' book was published in October 2006 in the States. And within a few days of its publication, something happened in Pennsylvania. Many of you will know about this. It's a very, very sad story that some kind of mad, deluded gunman went into an Amish school. The Amish are very conservative Protestants who live a kind of 17th century lifestyle. You've probably seen pictures of them. And shot dead five schoolgirls. It was appalling. But the Amish take Jesus exceptionally serious. And because Jesus was non-violent, they were too. And did they demand retribution? No. They offered forgiveness. Very important point. The widow of the gunman said that gave her and her daughters the space they needed to begin to build their lives all over again after that catastrophe. I am sure religion can lead to violence. But the key point here is that Jesus, I think, if taken seriously, offers a very different way. Now, Dawkins doesn't seem to know very much about Jesus. And this concerns me, I have to say, because it does seem to me this is enormously important. Dawkins quotes a friend of his who basically argues, I put this quote on the screen, but I'll read it out to you in a moment, who argues that basically all Jesus did was to reinforce Jewish identity, in effect just keeping the same old values. Jesus was the devotee of the same in-group morality coupled with out-group hostility that was taken for granted in the Old Testament. Jesus was a loyal Jew. It was Paul who invented the idea of taking the Jewish God to the Gentiles. Hartung, the man he's quoting, puts it more bluntly than I dare. Jesus would have turned over in his grave if he'd known that Paul would be taking his plan to the pigs. Well, it's provocative, isn't it? Let's just leave it like that. The argument then is Jesus is simply reinforcing Jewish in-group identity, which means increased hostility towards out-groups, i.e. the Gentiles. It's good to be speaking at St. Ebb's, because I think you know your New Testaments well enough simply to say that is rubbish. And so it is. Let me just mention a few things. Number one, Jesus actually commended loving your enemies. Let's just remember that. Number two, Jesus extended the parameters of the kingdom of God to take in everyone, breaking down those barriers. The true sons of Abraham, so to speak, are not those who are physically descended from him, but rather those who put their faith in this God. But think also of the most famous parable of all, perhaps, in Luke's gospel, the parable of the Good Samaritan. What's that saying? It's all about the necessity of Jews and Samaritans actually doing things together, alongside some extremely important reflections on who is my neighbor and the nature of God as the one who brings forgiveness. Now again, I'm not going to dwell on this, but what I want to simply say is when Dawkins does engage with explicitly religious issues, he frankly does show himself to be out of his depth. Let me wrap this up, because I'm running out of time. You've been extremely patient. Dawkins is absolutely clear that religion is a bad thing. But let me ask you this question. How might one show that religion is bad empirically? Now, those of you who have enjoyed reading Sigmund Freud will know that religion is pathological. And certainly that would have been thought to be the case until about perhaps 25 years ago. But of course, as you all know, things have rather moved on. How do we determine that religion is bad empirically? It's been a subject of massive research in the last 15 years. I'm just going to show you some references to let you follow this through if you'd like to. There is growing interest in exploring the impact of religious commitment on well-being and longevity. Now, obviously, there is a huge range of questions that need to be looked at. How do you actually establish who is religious and who is not? How do you allow for variable income? How do you allow for social status? Whole range of questions. Let's allow for that, as they have done. And what you find, for example, here in Koenig and Cohen, the link between religion and health, psychoneuroimmunology and the faith factor, is some extremely interesting factors. I'm going to show you some figures. These do not prove there is a God. They do not constitute the end of this experiment. They're still ongoing, but nevertheless, you'll find them interesting. Of 100 studies, not 100 people, 100 peer-reviewed studies, looking at the link between religious commitment and well-being, 79 reported at least one positive correlation between religious involvement and well-being. Then there were 20. 13 which found no meaningful association, 7 that found a little bit good, a little bit bad, no overall picture, and 1 that found a negative association between religion and well-being. Now, I don't want to overstate this, but I think you can see the point. If Dawkins were right, and that is a very, very big if, these ought to be the other way up. You know, religion ought to be having a negative impact. It ought to be screwing you up in a very big way, which is the take-home message of the God delusion. But the evidence actually suggests religion may be quite a good thing for you. Those of you who are politically inclined might notice there is a very significant agenda here for public health care issues. If there is any kind of positive link between religion and well-being, then why isn't religion in the public health care system? I won't follow that through, but you can see this starts off lots of interesting debates. And again, I've published on that myself. So I must wrap up because you've been extremely patient. I just want to ask a few very, very brief questions. Who is this book written for? I'll tell you what I think. I may be wrong completely. I think this book is primarily written for atheists who are worried about their faith, who feel that the resurgence of interest in religion is very bad news. They would like to be able to refute this and say this is simply a hysterical outbreak of irrationality and delusion, which happily we, as intelligent, rational people, can stand aloof from. I think there is an atmosphere of anxiety. Maybe we're wrong. Maybe the reason why Dawkins' arguments are so simplistic is that the minute they start getting complex, all kinds of interesting possibilities begin to come in that he doesn't want to talk about. How should Christians respond? There is nothing for you to fear here whatsoever. What you need to be aware is that this book does two things. Number one, it shows there is an overwhelming case for good religious education, for the honest, objective teaching of what, for example, Christianity really says, rather than the slightly daft misrepresentations we find in the God delusion. If people took that as fact, we would really be in a bad way. We need to press for decent religious education, which tells it as it is, not spins it as we find in the God delusion. But secondly, I want to stress to those of you who are Christians the importance of apologetics. That means taking trouble to go into your faith, to be reassured of its credentials, to ask how these concerns can be met, not simply to deepen your own faith, but to be able to help your friends who are asking questions and be able to rebut some of the slightly wacky ideas we find in the God delusion. And finally, what does this tell us about the present state of atheism? I used to be an atheist. I have to say to you that I am very glad I am not an atheist now, because I think I would find this book deeply disturbing, because it would make me wonder if I had made a very big mistake. Michael Ruse is professor of philosophy at Florida State University. He describes himself as being a hard-nosed Darwinian, and he is most certainly an atheist. He wrote, "The God delusion makes me ashamed to be an atheist." It's not a good book. If you are an atheist here tonight, I think you need to find an alternative patron saint very quickly. You've been extremely patient. Thank you very much indeed for listening.
Thank you, Alistair, very, very much. Alistair is very happy to field questions, and we had put out bits of paper that we might have written questions in. In actual fact, we're going to have them from the floor. But we're going to have a five-minute break first, and there may be some want to slip away. Many of us may want to stretch our legs for a moment, but just a very short break, and then we'll have questions for 25 minutes or so. Can I encourage people to take a seat again? And if you've been standing, there may be one or two free seats now. Do find a seat and rest your legs. Whilst you do that, I might also just say, afterwards, there is a table at the back. We've got some of Alistair's books, particularly relevant for the topic of tonight. His new book, The Dawkins Delusion, is to be available in a few weeks' time. We've got some advanced copies, so there's a few of those at the back, and his book, The Dawkins God. And I think there's maybe another book or two of his as well. So do browse those bookstores afterwards. But Alistair, over to you for some questions.
Right, we're just going to take questions and see how many we can get round. I think what we're going to do is, we have a microphone here, we're going to kind of just go in a sweep, because we only have one microphone and we're going to have to take this, we're going to try and get, we must end by 1:30, in fairness to all of you, but we're going to try and get round as many as we can. I've got to apologise in advance if we don't get round everybody, but we'll try and get round, and I'll try and give as quick answers as I can. But if a question seems to me to be really important, I may linger a little bit, because I assume that you prefer me to deal with some questions in some depth, and I'm very happy to do that. Let's just begin. We're going to start here and work our way round. We have a question there in about the fourth row back.
Yeah, it's actually more of a comment. I just wanted to suggest that maybe there's, I know you were very short of time, so maybe you addressed this in other talks, but I wonder if there's another conclusion that you could add, which is how should scientists respond? Because I'm a scientist, and I've had similar views to yours, and it's something that I think is very important for scientists who have problems with Dawkins' thoughts. And I think you elegantly explained the whole error that a lot of scientists make in not understanding that they can neither prove nor disprove, but all they're doing is actually generating hypotheses which fit with the observations. And I just wonder whether part of that problem is the fact that philosophy isn't part of scientific training in the UK. And you didn't mention Karl Popper, but if you could comment on
that. Yes, certainly. I'd glad to do that. Thank you. I mean, it's a good point. Dawkins mentions Karl Popper infrequently. He mentions him once in Devil's Chaplain, published in 2003. He describes him as a philosophical truth heckler. In other words, he's raising questions that make everything seem needlessly complicated. But in fact, Popper is raising some very good questions about the limits of science, about how one goes about verifying or indeed falsifying things. They are very legitimate questions indeed. So I take your point immediately about the need for a kind of philosophical grounding there. And indeed, you know, if I could just say this quite frankly, I mean, the God delusion is innocent of philosophical engagement. It's very interesting just to read it from that perspective. What can you do as scientists? I think there's a very significant issue here, and that is that there is a real problem for science at the moment. It is not well regarded. It is particularly not well regarded in some religious circles, and I'm afraid the reason for this is because people say, well, Dawkins says science is atheistic, therefore it's atheistic. We believe in God, therefore we're having nothing to do with it. And I deeply regret that. And I think that one of the things I'd want to say is that scientists who are Christians should really present the counterposition very, very clearly. Not simply because it needs to be heard, but also because I think really the good name for science is at stake. Richard Dawkins is the professor of public understanding of science, and the public understanding of science he generates is that it is irredeemably anti-religious. I don't believe it is at all. But if I'm just a lone voice, you know, that's bad news. I know I'm not. What we need is scientists to be able to stand up and say, we think this way too. So I'd encourage a bit of activism here. I think there's a lot could be done, and I'd very much encourage you to take those good thoughts further. Thank you. Let's just keep going. We do have a lot of hands. We'll just keep going back. Again, my apologies if we can't get to everyone. There seems to be someone there standing up behind the pillar, just about 60 degrees from me, just there. Just keep going. Yes. We're nearly there. Nearly there. No, we've got lost. Just come forward. Come towards me.
Oh.
We're there.
Okay, great. Look, to be frank, I don't believe you're fully engaged with the main points of the God delusion. That's just my opinion. I want to put one of the main points I derived from that book to you now. You mentioned earlier about how Dawkins posits as analogous to the existence of God, the existence of the tooth fairy, the existence of Santa, that kind of thing. But he also posits as analogous the existence of Thor, the existence of Muhammad, of other Votan, other religious conceptions. And he very, you know, and he points out factually, if most of the people in this room were born in a different, you know, space on earth, were born in a Muslim country, that's the creed we would be defending today, right? If we're born in China or in Tibet or whatever. Because he puts this forward as a fact, he also says, because this is so, because your religious conviction or your kind of religious background will be informed by, you know, your surroundings, it is actually highly immoral to speak of things like a Catholic child, a Muslim child. That's one of the main points he says. It's actually unfair towards children to label them like that because they've actually never had an opportunity to make up their minds rationally. How would you feel about that?
Well, I think he makes a good point there. I'm all for not ramming dogmas of any kind down children's throats. And for that reason, I hope people would not read The God Delusion to children because it is such a flagrant misrepresentation of religion. And you say I haven't done justice to Dawkins at all. I've only had 50 minutes to talk. And clearly I've had to be selective in some way. But let's take the point that you make. I mean, Dawkins there, I think, really shows that he is a scientist who has not really had to think about issues of philosophy. And again, if you take one of his dominant themes, there is reason. For Dawkins, the big dialectic actually isn't so much between science and religion, it's between what he calls reason and superstition. He then morphs these into, reason, science, superstition, religion. And of course, the key point is that rationality is a socially conditioned concept. If you look at Alistair MacIntyre, if you look at John Dewey, if you look at Michel Foucault, one of the key points being made there is that it's ridiculous to assume that somehow human rationality is a constancy down the ages across cultures. Actually, it varies hugely. The point is we are all prisoners of our historical origins, whether we like it or not. It's not simply a religious issue. It's not just cuius regio, eius religio. It's cuius regio, eius ratio. And therefore, the key point is that Dawkins is in effect saying, let's get rid of religion, let's have reason. But actually, reason itself is strongly socially conditioned. And I think that's one of the great weaknesses of his book, that in effect, he is proposing as an alternative religion something that itself is as socially conditioned and socially constructed as anything else. Now, one might say, well, actually, doesn't science ride to the rescue here? Because it, after all, is universal. And that might well be a very important point to make. But again, if science has limits, it is simply about the investigation of the material world and really hits very severe difficulties in relation to questions of meaning, questions of value, then you can see immediately that either we say we can't do those, we just leave those to one side, or else we begin to develop those from somewhere else. Dawkins himself is very clear, science has no means for determining what is ethical. The good life matters to most of us. So where do we find out what the good life is? I mean, in many ways, we're just going straight back to the pre-Socratic philosophers who asked, but sadly did not answer, those key questions. Thank you. Let's move, we have to move around this way. There is a gentleman here at the back. Just follow my hand is stretching. Thank you.
Hello. I'm more convinced by the last answer you gave than the general rhetoric of the talk. The middle of your argument where you critique Hawkins' book is, I think, very good and sound, that he's got all these kind of blind spots. He doesn't really understand religion. He's coming from this kind of rationalist perspective and trying to talk about things which he can't. I'm perplexed by the way you started your argument, however, by talking about, posing the idea that the fact that religion is on the rise and that atheism has been around for so long as being some sort of evidential point. And then the fact that you said, you know, it's in the rise in certain countries like America, but it seems to be on the wane in the Western, in Western Europe, for example. And the reason why this has perplexed me through your talk is there seems to be, to me, a vague, maybe a sort of a faint sort of political undertone. The fact that you use 9/11 as your only example of religious fanaticism seems to me slightly unnerving when you consider that there was a huge cycle of violence that was caused by that, that was apparently...
Yes, if you could get to the question, sorry, there are others.
Apparently posed in very strictly like Christian grounds. You know, Bush said the Iraq war was, God-given. How do you respond to that? I mean, these examples, the rhetoric that you've used could be taken by an audience in a Christian church for a validation of Christianity
We've heard the question. I think in responding to that, why do I focus on 9/11? Well, because Dawkins does. Dawkins is very, very clear. He wrote the book in response to 9/11. And therefore, I thought one must do him justice by looking at what for him was the motivating cause for writing this book. And if you look, for example, at Daniel Dennett's book, Breaking the Spell, or indeed Sam Harris's book, Letter to a Christian Nation, you'll see that both of those are very, very clear. The motivation for this was 9/11. And therefore, I felt it was very important to identify with that and take it very, very seriously. There is, I think, a political agenda to Dawkins' own book in that, he really talks about religion, but when you begin to look at the religions he talks about, it basically is Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, which, of course, are monotheistic. And the real difficulty, I think, is, as I was suggesting, Dawkins does not have a criteriology which allows us to say, this is a religion, this is belief in God, what's the difference between them? So I think it's very important just to set the context. Now, in terms of setting the context, what I did towards the beginning was saying, look, we are faced with this very interesting phenomenon of religion having resurged. Now, that was not an argument. That was simply context setting. I think it's always important when you're beginning to examine a thing to look at the backdrop against which it arose. Now, looking at your face, I would say you're much younger than I am. And certainly when I was growing up, when the sociologists, bless them, were saying, religion is on its way out. You know, if you read them in the late 1960s, early 1970s, we are moving into a secular era. And really, it's an intriguing question. Why has that not happened? What's going on here? And certainly, one of the issues here is why prophecy failed in the case of those great predictions of the rise of secularism. And so what I was trying to make is that if one's trying to account for the rather unusual tone of the God delusion could hardly be described as an objective or fair or level-headed book. It is extremely aggressive and dogmatic. And that is, what atheist commentators are saying, which is why I think actually it helps understand why I think most atheists are distancing themselves because they feel it might well give them a bad name. But I think my concern was to try and understand the particular animus with which it was written. And it seems to me it was that sense of bewilderment mingled with anger at the rise of religion when this shouldn't have happened. And so I think really I was just trying to set the context for this intriguing book rather than offering a detailed analysis of its every point. Thank you. Now, we've got lots around here. Let's move, if we may, to this gentleman in the back row.
The kind of main thrust of your talk was to accuse atheism of suffering from precisely the same defects as the major religions in terms of being in some way a religious creed itself. And I think that's just a fundamental mistake. Atheism arises from the view that all our beliefs should be grounded in evidence.
Well, I think
that there's not sufficient...
Let me stop you there. I mean, that is very, very contestable, and I will come back to that.
Okay, sure. So atheism is grounded in the view that all your beliefs should be based on evidence, that there's insufficient evidence to prove the existence of God, and that it's more probable that God doesn't exist, whereas faith-based approach to the world just denies the relevance of evidence to that kind of question.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. No. I mean, this is not a question. This is just nonsense. I mean, let me begin to engage with you. I mean, the key point here is that there's a real, genuine debate about what the best explanation is. And Gilbert Harman cannot be ignored. How would you respond to Gilbert Harman's argument that we cannot have the evidential certainty that you are proposing? Could you answer that?
Well, but... Atheism in science has never claimed to provide absolute certainty. It's claimed to provide, as you say, the best explanation. But a faith-based approach doesn't provide any explanation whatsoever.
No, that is not so. That is what an atheist textbook would tell you. If you talk to religious people, they will say something very different. And again, I must not allow Christianity to be misrepresented. I mean, C.S. Lewis would say, look, Christianity offers you an excellent explanation. Here are arguments. Here are ways of looking at things. I entirely accept if you say, I believe that my way of looking at things is better than yours, but please don't imply or even say that Christians don't think about these things. Well, you need to meet more people.
It seems that that's the definition of faith, isn't it? Isn't that exactly the definition of faith, though?
No.
The persistence of belief despite the fact that there may not be enough evidence to support
Listen. I mean, I teach a basic course in Christian theology at this university. I'd be very glad to welcome you along. I mean, this is not what Christians say, and this is the key point. You need to understand what Christians are saying. They do not go around dogmatically saying things with arrogance and certainty. If you want to look for that, I fear perhaps the book we've been talking about tonight might be a more interesting resource than anything else.
Well, I mean, if we're going to resort to ad hominems, then there's really no point in continuing the discussion.
I think actually you may have begun that. Let me just say for the sake of clarity that the real issue here is how we make sense of things. We need to be aware that there are many competing explanations and none of them are knocked down. And I do not say atheists have no reason for taking their position. I would not allow anyone to say that Christians have no reason for taking their positions. The real issue is that there is no meta-criterion. In other words, in plain English, something objectively transcended by which they may be judged. And what I'd want to do is urge respect for all these positions instead of dismissing one as being arbitrary or wrong. There's a real need, I think, here for tolerance. Thank you. Let's move on. We have lots here towards the front. I think we must try and take some in. We are running very seriously of time. We may have time for perhaps two more. One there, and then perhaps... Tough. One there, certainly.
If one looks maybe not at your religion, but at a close derivative, there are lots out there, according to some estimates, there have been maybe 80,000 religions or sects. But let's take the case of, say, Mormonism. Yeah? Now, I would want to say either the DNA evidence is wrong, or Joseph Smith in the Book of Mormon is wrong about Red Indians being descended from Jews. Dawkins claims, that what he's interested in is not whether the religion is good for you, but there's an issue of truth here. Isn't
it? Well, it certainly is. And I think that one of the key questions is how we decide what is true. And again, that key phrase, what is truth, is a hugely important question for all of us. And again, one of the ways you might look at this is what is the evidential basis of something? And again, that is a very important debate to have. And again, between Christians and atheists, we need to look at that very, very closely. In the case of Mormonism, I believe it's wrong. And I believe it can be shown to be wrong on historical grounds. And therefore, I share Dawkins' desire to engage critically with that. What I'd want to say is we need to be critical of what Christians say, we need to be critical of what Mormon says, we need to also be critical of what atheists say, because I do believe that if we take the God delusion as being typical, then we have, I regret to say, a misrepresentation of what Christians believe to be the case. But also, as Terry Eagleton pointed out in the London Review of Books, in 400 pages, not a recognition at any point that religion actually might have done some good at all. So I think there's a real need here to look at what the objective grounds of something are. But interestingly, there is the question of what truth means. And truth could mean simply something which corresponds to the evidence, and that is certainly true. And there are many things like that. For example, I will give offense to any Albanians here, but I will say that Tirana is the capital of Albania. But it doesn't really excite me very much. It doesn't actually animate me or make me want to get up in the morning and be happy. And the point is, really, something can be true, but actually dull. It can be irrelevant. And the real question, I think, is not simply evidentially grounded, but also charged with the capacity to transform life. It's existentially significant as well. And that seems to me to be an enormously important point to make. When I was an atheist, I believed that had it. Now I believe that Christianity has it, this enormous capacity to transform things. In other words, grounded in reality, but also with this capacity to engage and transform. We have time for one more, and I'm acutely aware I'm going to lose about 65 friends by choosing one. We have not had a woman questioner. Is there a woman who would like to ask a question? There is, so can we just go back there to the far side of the pillar, and we will make sure we hear a voice.
Just when you were talking about memes, you were saying that it's by science we can never be able to find them, therefore they don't exist. Is that not quite similar to Richard Dawkins' argument that because with science we will never be able to find God, he doesn't exist?
It's an intriguing question, and it's one I've actually long wondered about. I mean, Dawkins would argue that when one looks at the dynamics of intellectual transmission, or the way in which cultures transmit ideas, one has to posit something which cannot be seen, cannot actually be identified, but nevertheless, again, this dreadful phrase, the best explanation of how cultural transmission takes place. And therefore, I think you're right. I mean, I think that in one sense, Dawkins believes in memes as Christians believe in God. Now, obviously, the analogy breaks down very, very quickly, but there is that element to it. The real difficulty with memes, if I had time to go into this in more detail, is that there are many other alternative explanations. And for example, if you look at that excellent book by Unger, Darwinizing Culture, which looks at the whole idea of the meme in considerable detail from the perspective of a number of disciplines, Maurice Bloch, who's professor of anthropology at LSE, simply makes the point that actually all the phenomena that Dawkins suggests could be explained by the meme actually are explained by mechanisms well known to anthropologists. So he's just saying actually that the answer lies in a radically different place, and that the answer does not come from biology, but from anthropology. But I mean, to be fair to Dawkins, and we must be fair to him, I mean, there is an interesting parallel here, and that is that regularly we have to look at observation and say, in order to explain what we can see, we have to posit something that we cannot see. I mean, for example, if you take J.J. Thompson, The Discovery of the Electron, I mean, Thompson, in effect, was saying, I have this set of observations which are intriguing, and I can't really explain them unless I propose there is something which is currently undetectable, invisible, intangible, which actually is he thought of as being a particle with unit negative charge. And if there were that, this would explain his observations. Now, of course, as you will know, as time progressed, you know, that was ratified, very, very excitingly so. But to begin with, Thompson's position was, I can't prove this, but I'm positing this entity and saying that is the best way of making sense of things. And actually, it's a classic example of exactly this process of inference to the best explanation. To make sense of this, 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 and this, I propose this, and expect one day to be able to find it, even though at the moment it can't be seen. And actually, from a Christian perspective, that makes perfect sense. That is a very good description of the way in which some Christians would talk about how they believe God is the sense maker of this world in which we find ourselves. I've had to disappoint a lot of you. I do apologize for that. Some excellent questions. Clearly, we could have gone on for a long, long time. I have written to Professor Dawkins asking him to debate, because I think it is much better that he and I have a face-to-face rather than this rather unsatisfactory interaction with a book. If that ever comes about, we'll make sure you all get to hear about it. Thank you very much.